I had a number of observations. The first is actually a question on page 6 of the presentation to which Mr. Chitenzi spoke. His second bullet point on the National Treasury and South African Reserve Bank reads as follows: questions whether amendments go far enough and are intrusive given the lessons learned after the 2008 global financial crisis. It's not a very clear statement, because if you could just please clarify what that means, whether the amendments go far enough, and then and are intrusive, which seems like a redundancy, or perhaps a misstatement, or are intrusive enough. It's just not clear what you mean by that. It's a very important clarification because it defines the constitutional relationship between consumer rights that we are trying to protect and the exercise of executive power, which we're trying to define with amendments to the law and the regulations being proposed. And it's a really important issue because it's not entirely clear whether we are bringing about reforms to regulate reckless lending or reckless borrowing, and what the relationship between those two things are. Maybe we're trying to do both, maybe we're trying to do some and so on. It just needs clarity, because contained there are some constitutional questions about the rights of consumers to borrow recklessly as opposed to the rights of lenders to lend recklessly. Clearly what we're trying to do is stop reckless lending. So that's my first question. The second is that you say that self-regulation does not work. And I'd like to know whether you've done a study of that and whether you can present this committee with an outcome of such a scientific study. Or is it based on anecdotal evidence or episodic evidence or court cases? I mean, what is your evidence of making that claim? I want to believe you, but I'd like to see the evidence, please. The third question is whether you've actually measured the cost of the changes you're proposing. What does it mean in financial terms, the implications of the changes you're proposing? Have you done a study of that? Is there a report? Can we see the report, please? And a final question has to do with the old issue about whether regulations are secondary laws. Parliament makes the laws, and we will decide what's appropriate as honourable members in this Parliament. There's a real fear of ruling by regulation and decree as opposed to ruling by law. When we have a constitutional state and we govern by law, not by regulation. Regulations are permitted by the law, and they are defined by the law. But we must be very careful about running a country based on the regulations and not by law. So I'm not saying we're doing that. I'm just saying that we need to look at this question more carefully. And can I just end by, on a lighter note, that deals with these issues of balance between consumers and providers. Some of us are really interested in the history of words. And the discipline is called etymology, and I was really curious about where Garnaschi comes from, because it sounds like somebody's surname. So I just did a little bit of research, and it just reveals, the history of this word reveals the tensions we're referring to about between consumers and providers. Garnish, that comes with the word garnish, which is an old English word that first came into circulation in this between 1620 and 1630, and it means to provide in the English language. But it derives from the French, spelled G-A-R-N-I-S, which means to grant flavor. And the French are consumed with food, right? And so it's about adding flavor, which is to the benefit of the consumer of the food. It's really important just to think about this. But the French derives from the Frankish, which is old German, which means to provide equipment to protect the provider of equipment, the artisan, making military equipment for the army. And that's the protection. It says provide and protect the suppliers of military equipment to the German army. And that's a protection not to the consumer, but it's a protection. It's like an old value chain system that's medieval, to protect the provider. And so I think it's really interesting in terms of language history, but it also reflects the tension between whether you're protecting the consumer, as in the case of the French use of the word, as opposed to the protecting the provider, which is the German sense of the word. Thanks.
I would hope that we're going to follow South African English. But I must say, very interesting that, indeed, it was interesting for all of us to get the origins of that word itself, and perhaps the confusion that is created sometimes. Honourable Salam?
You know, lighter notes from PhDs are also always informative. We have been able to learn quite a lot from this lighter weight. Chairperson, the tribunal in the presentation expressed that the role of a tribunal is like that of a court. And I think that's what we want to provide for in the legislation. But equally, the presentation that I was a little bit late for by the parliament advisor is making reference to courts also in respect of the same act. Now, I just want to try and get whether in our definition we are able to can make a clear distinction between the court and the tribunal, especially in respect to roles. Because in terms of how the tribunal was putting it, it is there are cases now where some people who were not satisfied with outcomes they made have taken them to court, up to the highest courts of the land, just before the Constitutional Court. I'm not very sure as to who plays what role to what extent. And what do we want to see happening? Do we establish a tribunal that will be taken to court every day? Or do we want to give it powers similar to that of a court, except in issues that are of a nature that a tribunal in its nature cannot be able to handle? That is the one issue. The second issue is that in all the responses I have heard today, I might have missed it, and if I did so, my apologies. The judge mentioned in his presentation that as he looks at this bill and the act as a whole, the principal act and the amendment bill, both of them together, he does not see how they address nationwide issues in relation to consumer. In his view, it addresses some people and not the whole. And I have not heard the response both from DTI and from Parliament Advisor in respect to this particular area. I would be happy to can hear if there's anything on our side or our view in respect to this particular matter. Chairperson, the presentation by the Parliamentary Advisor on the cost of credit seems a relief at face value. But if you look at it much more deeper, she made reference to 200 rand that in whatever you do, your interest on non-repayment cannot go above that 200, which is the capital. But you know, it's easy when you look at it in 200. But if you look at it in 200,000, then you look at interest becoming 200,000, then you begin to see that no, this is not really a relief. Maybe we should re-look at that and see if we could not make it much lesser than the capital. On the, and I have not heard anything said on the interest rates, particularly in respect to personal loans. I know it goes up to something like 31%. We are not seemingly saying anything about that interest rate. I think it's very high and needs to be looked at one way or the other. But there's also this criminal activity within that market. There's a lot of criminal activity, people sending you false information that you have won 500 million rand with the lotto. All you must do is to send in your account number and name so that they can be able to deposit that money for you. The intention being that you send that account number and your name and you are able to access your account and take the little bit you have. That's a lot of criminal activity that is going on. We are receiving these SMSs and emails every day in our lives, some of us, from overseas, from South Africa, from government institutions and so on, and we know it's not correct. It must be stopped one way or the other. That criminal element, I do not hear of a provision in the Act that deals with how to trace and to deal with those criminals. I don't know if they are the people referred to as sharks. Father, I'm sorry, but
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Corporate Chair. Starting off by expressing appreciation for the inputs that have been made. But I want to make a remark that to invite more discussion, that the regulatory bodies, I think it's important that they stay independent, but they must cooperate with a view to complement each other. It is the same reason that informs the establishment of different departments, you know, because once we have everything housed under one roof, then we will do badly in terms of oversight, specializing, you know, we will find that we do a disservice to the public. So that's one comment that I'm making, that I tend to think the more independent, the better. But on the reckless and the reckless credit, my question is where the regulators find that the credit providers have provided credit recklessly. Do they take punitive measures to stop that, or it is just something that's noted? And because if it is just noted, it means it will just continue from one activity to another activity. So, especially in view of the poverty that's so wide-based amongst our people, it's important that some exemplary punishment gets executed so that these conducts stop. And on page 6, on bullet, the last bullet there, it merely emphasizes what I was saying when I say that coordination is great, it's important, cooperation is important, but it must not jeopardize the independence. And then my last point is what was emphasized by Member Silau, that the false adverts do we really have a way of dealing with them? Because they say hunger knows no law. If people advertise and say, here is buckets of money, come and fetch it. Here is buckets of money, come and fetch it.
Yeah.
It's very tempting. So do those people have a license to go on with that without being stopped? Thanks, Comrade Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Mabasa.
Did anyone else wish to make a comment or raise any questions? Honorable Swanepoel, followed by Honorable Waili.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got two issues that I'd like to raise. The first being on the removal of adverse credit. And I would just like to get a bit more of a understanding as to what is adverse credit, what is the adverse credit that's going to be removed versus what information is that's going to be retained on which the institutions, the banks, etc., can make their assessment, because you know they've made a lot of this story. And I also want to get an understanding because on the judgments that will be removed through the removal of adverse credit. If my understanding is correct, that can in any event now be removed if you got a rescinding order. So that would mean that the empowered people are able to clear the name, but poor people and rural people are not able to clear that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not really you're not really changing anything, because that if you were wealthy, you'd be able to remove that information in any event. So that is not really taking away anything that's already in place. It's just making it easier and empowering the poor. The chairperson got a problem with eye, so have I. Oh yes, okay. I'd also like to know what is the difference between what is being proposed here in terms of the removal of adverse credit versus what was done a couple of years ago. Okay, what is the difference there? Because my understanding was there was a total clearing of records a couple of years ago, whereas now it's just the removal of the adverse credit. But I'd like to get an understanding on that. And then I would like to ask you this question. The National Credit Regulator deals with credit agreements, but there's a gap. What happens in a case where a person is involved in an accident? He then gets taken to a hospital, and they ask this guy with a broken leg, can we operate you? And he says, please, just take the pain away. And they operate him, and he incurs tens of thousands of rands worth of debt. And then he ends up with a judgment against him because he's not able to pay that debt. It's not a credit agreement, but it is credit. So how do we deal with situations like that? And then I can cite examples of people that come to see me with panel beaters. You know, they fix the car up, and then there's extra costs that are incurred, and because you don't have that cost to pay it, they don't release your car, they hold your car hostage, and they charge you storage fees. Okay, this case that came to me. The storage fee was worth more than the value of the car. It's not a credit agreement, but it's credit. Okay. And then, the tow trucks. I mean, please, you know, you're putting in the back of an ambulance, they're asking you to tow your car, where you say, well, if you're conscious enough to say it, many times they just take it. And then they charge the storage fees. It's not a credit agreement, but it's credit. How do we protect people in that instance? Shouldn't that also be built into the responsibility of the National Credit Regulator as well? So there's that. Then the second issue deals with the caps on interest rates. Now, there's a difference between a cap on interest rate and a cap on the cost of credit. There's two issues here. And we need to look at capping the cost of credit. And I take you back to Wonga,
mm-hmm.
who I see today had a lot to say in one of the newspapers I read on the plane. Sorry, Madam Chairperson, I was late, but the plane was delayed. But it allowed me the opportunity to read about Wonga at least. But I mean, yeah, the information we've got here already shows that short-term transactions, and I'd like a definition, what is a short-term transaction? How many months is a short-term transaction? But they already can get 50% per month. That is 60% per year, which the credit regulator, whoever gives these caps, is allowed. And we saw the example last week where a guy for 21 days paid the equivalent of 392%. And by the way, I went to refresh my memory on wongo.com in the UK. Just do a Google search, which I'm sure you've done already. But there's huge issues in the UK also about them charging these payday lenders, etc. So it's not unique to South Africa as well. Okay.
And they would double the cost?
Yes. So I would like to know whether it's not possible to define, not to put a cap on the amount of interest that is charged, but a cap on the cost of credit. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Honourable
Swanepoel,
Honourable Waiili.
Thanks very much, Comrade Chairperson, and thanks from the DDG and the team for some of the preliminary responses. I think I want to move from the basis of the objectives of the Act, that the National Credit Act of 34, 2005 aims to promote and advance the social and economic welfare of South Africans. I think we must always move from that particular basis, even as we measure our successes and our pitfalls. It must be within that particular framework. But also the purpose as well is to ensure that we prevent reckless lending. And the fact and the reality that confronts us is that huge percentage of the population is swimming in the debt spiral. And I want to refer to this as a social time bomb because of its own diverse effects in different sectors of the society. It impacts on production. It impacts negatively at homes. It gives the reverends and pastors more work to do because of the unintended consequences. That's the nature and the character of what we're confronted with. Hence, I would always regard it as maybe it needs to be declared as a national emergency, whether you call state of emergency, so that we can draw the attention of different role players because of the magnitude of challenges that confronts the population. But coming to questions, one of the questions relates to the issue of the African bank scenario, which was painted here. But I'm not dealing with African bank as the institution. I want to address a principal issue where you have raised Mr. Netstand, that whatever we're doing, we must always be cautious of the currency. How do we protect the currency? Does this give leverage to financial institution to behave in whatever form, and is this not compromising our independence and also our role in terms of executing our mandate? I know the importance of protecting the currents, but how do you strike a balance with that perspective vis-a-vis the main objectives of the Act? The second question relates to the issue of the debt councillors. Because there's a view that debt collectors and debt councillors, there's a level of irresponsibility which at times plunges the consumers into crisis. Even if we go the tribunal route, but what is fundamental, even if you deregister them, but what is fundamental is that how do you recoup the money? Because even if you can send somebody to jail, but how do you ensure that a poor consumer's money is recouped from the debt counselor and that money is paid to the relevant credit provider? Because you can put all other stringent measures in terms of punishment, but it, if that does not have an element of protecting and recouping what has been collected from the consumer, I think it has got serious limitations. It's unfortunate that maybe we need to have a Comrade Chairperson, the view of the Department of Justice. Crime is a crime. Even if you steal a sweet in a shop, you go to jail. And the constitution of the country says all shall be equal in the law, that it is derived from the Freedom Charter. But it seems as if some people are not equal when it comes to law. There are some people who can embark on criminal and fraudulent activities, exploiting the poor of the poorest, and they will always escape. I know the issue of the power relations in the society, which may always not in favor of the poorest because they don't have lawyers, they don't have funds, but the government's responsibility is to intervene for the well-being of all people in the population. At what stage can we have the Department of Justice in terms of this particular aspect? Because as government, we must be able to find a way of closing any gap that exists, especially during this particular process. And one area which I thought you were going to reflect on is the issue of the debtor's book. When you buy this book, you tell to the fifth person. Even myself, I was boxing a number of people which have paid long time ago, but one doctor is in UK, but we still have people who are collecting on behalf of that doctor. So no, we have bought the book. I said, I've paid. So I've managed to box with them successfully, but not every person can be able to have those capabilities of engaging with these people. How do we put the measures in between in terms of protecting the consumers, but also how do you avoid a kind of a double dipping in a very fraudulent manner, exploiting gaps that are existing? I think the last one is an issue around the role of the NEDLAC. Because whether we like it or not, this situation has got far-reaching implications in terms of the productivity level. You go to workplaces on Mondays, it's difficult to get production. Production picks up on Tuesday. But on Thursday, once workers get their pay slips, then it begins to drop because and Friday, I know that particular space. And you'd find situations that where workers have got 20 rand, 20 rand. I've listened to the deputy governor last week in terms of his responses. I think some of his responses are not 100% correct. It's unfortunate that in terms of understanding the social economic and environment, how workers find themselves in terms of different... I also agree that at times there are a number of insurance companies. Some is because of complacence, but some is because they've got 15 people who are looking on them. You become a breadwinner because we've got what is called extended family members. And how do you strike a balance on some of those particular things? But the issue, that the point that I want to drive home, how do we deal with that particular space in terms of engaging employers and trade unions in the context of ensuring that we also ensure that we put safety valves in terms of the productivity and the issues of the economy. Last is the pensioners. If you go to all the banks, you go on the first when there's a pension payout. It's quite a nightmare. You talk to machinists. When you go to ATMs, I also visited on the 1st of January. When even this week, I did the same. You go to the ATM, you'd find them machinists with all the cards, SASSA cards and green ID books of pensioners, and they've got their kids and children who are just like a magnet. And all the business cards, all of them, they are on the queue, tapping on this money, and there's no invoice. And some people, they tend to undermine that particular area of the machinists because the number of SASSA cards and the identity documents are not with the pensioners. Those documents are with the machinists. I think go every first, you will see people who are on the queues in terms of the ATMs are not the original people. Those are the machinists. After getting that money, they go back with a, it's a permanent feature, which I think we must also begin to look into. Thanks very much.
Yes, thanks for raising that particular point. DTI, DDG and Thule, you've got some of the inputs from our members here. I've no doubt we'll want to come back with a few more clarifications. But if you would deal with what you've already got this morning, thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I'm just going to allow the regulator first to just take some of the questions that I think they will better be in a position to respond to. And then we'll then see McDonald and the tribunal. I think there was just one question that related to them. I think obviously we're not necessarily expecting them to give input in terms of this bill, but to share the and respond in terms of those issues.
Thank you, DDG. Chairperson, the question around unsecured credit, which is your personal loans. The interest rate is very high, and that's why we've always been concerned about the fact that you have a level of over-indebtedness of consumers that is high, but at the same time, you know, you continue to see unsecured credit being pushed towards, you know, the same people that are over-indebted. But it is pleasing to note that for the past two quarters up to the end of September 2018, that there's been a contraction in terms of the extension of unsecured credit to consumers. Be that as it may, we have already started a study to look at review the interest rates, you know, and other charges that are allowed in terms of the Act. So that information will also be shared, you know, with the DTI at a later stage. But we have commenced such a study to review the fees and interest rates. One of them would obviously be, you know, what we are really looking at is this, you know, the interest rate that is levied under unsecured credit. In terms of enforcement action that we take on reckless lending, we have conducted quite a number of investigations, African Bank being one of them. It's already in the public domain. And what we would normally do is refer, and we have referred, you know, such cases to the National Consumer Tribunal. And in terms of the pension payout points, we have, together with SASA and the police, have raided, you know, gone around the country. Not in all provinces. We still have to visit two more provinces, but we've gone through seven provinces where we went to pension payout points and managed to get a number of small credit providers arrested. But we have referred, you know, some of those cases to the National Consumer Tribunal. The DTI, together with the Department of, you know, Social Development, are also working on an initiative around addressing that same problem. Because in terms of the act that SASA operates under, that card is illegal, you know, for to be used for credit purposes. I'm sure the DDG will also talk to that. I'm going to ask my colleague, Mr. Mashapa, to perhaps respond to some of those questions. Thank you.
Thank you, CEO. Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. We really appreciate this opportunity that has been given to us to address you on this important piece of legislation. The question by the Honorable James, which was taken from the National Treasury submission as to whether these amendments go far enough and are intrusive. I believe that the global financial crisis was caused by poor market conduct regulation. What we have in this legislation is we have reckless lending rules that prevents reckless lending to consumers. We are in the process of introducing affordability assessment guidelines, which eventually will become regulations. There are requirements in this legislation for all credit providers to disclose the cost of credit in the form of a quotation to the consumer. And the consumer will have a period of 5 days to shop around and look for the best deal. We also, in this legislation, regulate agents which are soliciting business on behalf of banks and credit providers. So on the inspection side, the regulator has wide-ranging powers to conduct inspections. When lenders are given the license to trade, they also agree in their conditions of registration for the NCR to enter their premises and seize documents. So we believe that these powers are sufficient and are intrusive. And I don't think what else can be done to improve them, because in my view, they are adequate. The issue of SMS marketing is properly regulated in the legislation. When consumers sign credit agreements, they are also given options as to whether they agree that credit providers should send them marketing material. So there will always be a document that you sign in which you indicate whether you want to be sent mail, SMSs, and other forms of marketing. The legislation also outlaws what we call negative option marketing. It's specifically not allowed. And the contents of advertisement and advertising materials are properly regulated in the regulations. For example, we have a specific regulation that says when you do advertising and marketing, you can't say no credit checks are done or blacklisted consumers welcome. So these this wheeling is prohibited in the regulations. With regards to reckless lending, the CEO has already indicated that we, and the DDG, that the NCR has now started with the enforcement of its enforcement strategy. We have seen a number of judgments issued by the tribunal last year, where a fine of 20 million rand was paid. There was another one of 450,000 rand on a micro lender. And we have also seen the tribunal cancelling the registration of many lenders for reckless lending. And may I also say that our investigations in Marikana in 2012 has led to the tribunal cancelling the registration of one lender already for reckless lending. And we have many other cases coming up for hearing at the tribunal. The differences between adverse and payment profile information, I think the chief director highlighted this. The credit bureau system, the way it operates in the country is we have many what we call data sets, you know, classes of information that are held by credit bureaus. There is one which we call adverse information, which is divided into two categories. The first one is where the behavior of the consumer is classified by the lender. For example, the lender says the consumer is a slow payer because he's not paying timeously the full installments, or where they say the consumer is delinquent. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that classification is displayed on the consumer's credit record for a period of 1 year. And then we have another classification which classifies the action that the lender takes. For example, the account is handed over for debt collection. That listing is displayed on the consumer credit record for a period of 2 years. Now, the challenge that we have now is, even if the consumer pays off the arrears and settles the account way before the what we call the retention period expires, that listing will not be removed. It has to stay there for the full retention period. And it impacts negatively on the consumer when they look for jobs. I have an email here, if there was time, that I could read, where the consumer was retrenched by a bank. It was, I think, 3 years after the recession hit. This consumer lost his house because he didn't have a job. And the bank took a judgment against him, which should now be displayed for a period of 5 years. In the meantime, he completed his BCom degree. He's applying for jobs everywhere, and he can't get any job because of this listing. Now, the problem is he is not able to pay the outstanding amounts because he's unemployed. So that's why we agree with the DTI that it is very important that, because of the continuing effects of the global financial crisis on our people who lost jobs, we should give them a once-off credit amnesty. And also, at the same time, if they settle the arrears, let's remove the listings. And then the payment profile information is information that displays how an account is paid on a monthly basis. The legislation allows credit bureaus to display this information for a period of 5 years. But what we do know is credit bureaus keep it for 5 years. This information will essentially consist of account payment history. So this information will not be removed through this project that we are undertaking. So we believe that lenders will be able to assess risk and price accordingly. And in addition to that, we are introducing affordability assessment guidelines, because we agree with the industry that the credit amnesty, I'm sorry, just calling it credit amnesty, it shouldn't result in over-indebted consumers obtaining more credit. So that's why we retain the payment profile information. At the same time, we implement affordability assessment guidelines. Thank you.
Was this a reference to amnesty, not adverse credit? Can we just get this clarification there? The word amnesty was used with respect to the new, the national credit amendment bill here in front of us. Just give it to me in terms of the amendment bill. Which clause refers to amnesty?
Sorry, Chair, it was my mistake. The name is the removal of adverse credit information. Sorry.
Thank you, Chairperson. In response to the Honourable Salah's question around a very clear distinction between the tribunal and the courts, the courts are created in terms of Section 165 of the Constitution, specifically Sections 167, 168, 169 and 170. The tribunal is created in terms of Section 26 of the National Credit Act. The functions of the tribunal are set out exactly in the National Credit Act in Section 27, and our function is therefore very strictly circumscribed in terms of what we can do in terms of the National Credit Act and the National Consumer Protection Act. And that is why the divergence basically ends. Where the convergence happens is that we are regarded as an entity that allows people to have a fair public hearing on a dispute in terms of the Constitution before a court, or where appropriate in terms before an appropriate tribunal in terms of Section 32 of the Constitution. Where this legislation has deemed it appropriate that matters get referred to the tribunal is because it gave the tribunal a specific way in which it has to do its work and conduct its hearings. In terms of Section 142 of the National Credit Act, we are charged with a responsibility to be quick, to be inquisitorial, to be informal, and to be fair to all the parties that appear before us. Then our decision, similarly as that of the lower courts or the magistrates' courts, can be taken to the High Court on appeal or review, where it is a three-member tribunal panel who sat on the matter. Where there's a one panel, that's it, a one-person panel, that matters get appealed to a full panel of the tribunal. So there are certain matters where the courts cannot hear cases. For example, where there is prohibited conduct in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, those matters has to come to the tribunal. Secondly, where the tribunal has made a finding of prohibited conduct in terms of any of these two pieces of legislation, the chairperson of the tribunal issues a certificate of a finding of prohibited conduct. And it's only upon filing of that certificate of prohibited conduct that the consumer or anybody can go forward to claim damages as a result of the prohibited conduct through the higher courts. So in essence, the difference is that the courts are established through the Constitution, the tribunal through other national legislation. I trust that answered the question.
No, thanks, Chair. A lot of some areas that I wanted to make an input have been covered by the NCR. But on the issue of page 6, intrusiveness, this is a presentation. Maybe the sentence construction is not complete, but the word intrusive was meant to say, is this act going to empower, say, the NCR fully to such an extent that what happened before 2008 financial crisis will never take place in future? I think that was meant to mean that the way how we phrase it, to say we put systems in place, enforce the act to its fullest extent, in so much that it must deter this practice that made the global crisis, in particular the US. Let me give you an example of the US scenario.
how it came. Generally, in the U.S., the credit providers and the credit regulators, seemingly they were lagged somewhere. You find that now credit was granted to students, say university students, who have got a potential to be employed in 4 years' time or 8 years' time. And then they go and ask for a loan, a housing loan, to say in any way in 6 years' time I will be employed. So they were not conducting in reality affordability assessment, strict as we want to do it now. Because this person only has the potential to be employed. Some of them will be dropouts, won't finish the university. But they were giving them these loans. That's how the US market collapsed. And the US government was forced to nationalize those two institutions. So therefore, we are saying, is this bill going to empower the NCR enough to curb those practices? And we think the affordability assessment criteria will deal with those issues. The reckless lending issues will also be dealt with correctly by the tribunal prosecution. The case of the African Bank was an example. Is it deterrent enough? Is it going to be deterrent enough? I'm just supplementing what my colleague has already said. Then there is this issue of Judge Fleming. If I may give sort of a history, how we came up with this salient point. There were many points raised, but we met as a team and said, what are the salient, major salient points raised? And then we agreed in the main on what is in the presentation, but there will be a grid that will be given to the honorable members. That grid will be showing response to virtually each and everything that was raised. Let me deal with Judge Fleming, the issue of contracts. Because what he submitted was to say, why is the credit agreement not applicable to the common law contract between two individuals? Between two individuals and some individuals who are lending credit but are not registered with the NCR, as an example. Not registered with the NCR, so therefore we are leaving a lot of people who are transacting, and then things are working, and then when there is a problem, you find that you have to apply the law of enrichment, and then our act was saying you cannot do that, as if we are saying the common law is no longer applicable in the area, and the court said no, you need still to apply the common law, and then we are saying the law of contract. The judge has given us a challenge to say how to see to it that we revamp our law to accommodate such, read together with the judgment that says the common law is not excluded in the credit agreement arena. So the judge also raised the issue of certificates as an example. Certificates to say, I am qualified to get a certificate from a debt counselor that I am a good payer, I've settled my debt. The judge went on to say, if I've settled my arrears, whether it's a long term or a short term, why can't I get a certificate that I'm a good payer, even if the original debt is still in existence? Because I will continue to service it. I've settled the interim problem. But there are different schools of thought within the committee, within ourselves, to say the credit providers are saying, settle also the original debt. But you ask yourself to say, why is there a dispute? The dispute is here because we are differing. I have settled all the arrears, and therefore I'm a good payer. I will continue with the installments on the original debt. That's what the judge was raising. I'm just raising this issue to show that we chose and picked seemingly the most salient points, but the rest we will respond in writing on the grid to each and everything. The SASSA issues, she responded, but it was also raised in writing. There was no presentation. We will also respond to them. I'm just allaying the fears that it seems as if we picked only the juicy one and the others will fall. So I hope I dealt with that thing, the issue of common law contracts. The issue of the credit amnesty, so-called, is called what, removal of adverse credit information project. Yes, that one. The one in 2000, the previous one was very limited. It was a once-off sort of. And then there was no education and awareness on the responsible borrowing and responsible lending, because we are dealing with the two issues, dealing with the responsible lending and responsible borrowing. Therefore, the issue of reckless lending and reckless borrowing. So the consumer can tell a lie, but the credit provider, so we are dealing with both. So education and awareness was not a feature in the previous one. So with this one, the project that we're talking about, people will have to know that the fact that now I'm out of debt, it does not mean that I'm out, the information is taken out now, and then I'm a clean person. It doesn't mean that I must be reckless again. Hence the issue of affordability assessment, reckless lending, if there is an enforcement. So things will balance there. And then the other issue, is except education and awareness, is that there is a section that we're saying the information must be automatic, taken out. I cycle the debt, it must be automatic removal of that information. And then, so that was not the case in the previous one. It was once off. This one, information, I do this, information must get out. And then I can come back to the circulation of comments again and then be credit worthy. So maybe there can be some supplement information, but I gave a high level thing. And then generally, I think there is that question on the medical expenses, the bush mechanics, tow trucks, and the like. I think it also talks to the issue of the judge to say the contract, there is a contract between two persons. And therefore, if there is a contract between two persons, let's see as to the equity and fairness of those contracts. Equity and fairness, the law of equity and fairness should be applicable. Is it a fair contract between two persons? And then we can apply the common law and deal with those issues. And then my colleague was informing me that there is a real contract, and then even if it's not a credit agreement issue, NCA, there is a contract between the two. But is it a fair contract? And I think what the judge was employing us to do was to say, why can't we deal with such issues? More that the judgment has said the law of contract should be applicable, and therefore let's see how, whether we want to legislate for it or not, but the issues of contract is a problem. So that's how superficially I can deal with it. So for me, it is unfair for the person to accumulate 2,000 interest, 20,000 interest, where the capital amount is so huge. You see the unfairness. But if it is a small one, to a small person without a salary, it's also huge. So the law of contracts, we need to come with some explanation. So the issue of regulation, self-regulation, the TDG will deal with it. There is a RIA regulatory impact assessment. Have we costed, I don't know whether English costed, there is a past tense of costed. Have we costed this act? That is a regulatory impact assessment on the bill. Yes, we have costed it. And I think there can be a circulation of that report. It was done, and then it will be circulated, probably. And then, but I don't have the cost now that I'm talking. But RIA, in the costing, was done of this bill. So the report can be circulated. That's how I can answer it. We can interrogate when maybe members have read the report and then see how it comes to. So generally, I think that's what I need to say. The issue of Honorable Waile, fraudulent criminality, the DDG, the coordination between our department and that the Justice Department. Just to give a process issue. When we were amending this thing, this act, we consulted with the DOJ, and then our minister wrote a letter to the Minister of Justice on all those issues of garnishee orders, all those things, and then the Minister of Justice responded by saying there is a bill in Parliament before the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Justice. Why can't you write the letter straight? We wrote the letter straight through the minister. And then we are talking, there is no outcome. There is no outcome per se, but the two departments are talking towards seeing a solution that on these issues of garnish orders and then the issue of coordination between the departments on the issue of credit, we need to come with a solution, the two departments. And then recently, I think National Treasury also said there is a project between us, the DTI, Finance, as well as DOJ. So the three departments again are inducted to work together to see to it that this issue of debt collection, which is happening, we don't have a jurisdiction on this side, they have a jurisdiction, whether it's administration, but consumers are being sort of left in the lurch, if I may say so. So there is something happening. The DDG may fill me up. So generally, I think NEDLAC, the NEDLAC issue, employer-employee, to talk about productivity, that the workers are overly indebted. There was also a presentation here that the employers are being used to debit and send it to the credit providers, and then what is it that we're doing in that regard. So I think we'll have to respond sufficiently when we respond to the to the grid, but all in all is that the employers are being part and parcel of debt collection, and then there may be a negative aspect if there is a fraud in between. These are criminal elements, and then are the police prosecution, are they dealing with such cases? And then you find that is not the case, but there is a need of coordination in this government institution. So generally, the ATM and the machinists, I think they dealt with it. So from my side, I think the DDG will deal with the remaining one, as I indicated.
Chair, with your permission?
Yes.
All right. Just a few points. I think my colleagues have covered the responses, but Chair, as I said, we will still come back just on some of the issues where we don't have a position. because we cannot give the answers to all of that. But I just wanted to give comfort to Honorable James that I think the issue of self-regulation, what McDonald was saying that it doesn't work, it was not a general statement. Working in the space of regulation ourselves, we know that there are various options. If the market works well, no regulation, we are happy. That's part of our mandate. If the market doesn't work well, then we also allow them to self-regulate. If self-regulation works very well, there's no need for the state to put in any legislation. So it does happen from time to time that as we review the areas, then you pick up certain areas where it doesn't work very well. Like in the area of affordability assessments, the research that has been conducted has indicated that the self-regulation part in that space doesn't work very well. Hence, we wish to empower the issuing of guidelines that will ensure consistency. So, but it is not a general statement, and I just want to give you comfort that we do want the market to self-regulate. And if consumers are protected sufficiently through self-regulation, then there certainly would not be a need for any intervention to protect where protection already exists. So I think in that case, just to clarify that, that's the sentiment really that we are expressing. And then in regards to the issue around reckless borrowing, we have indicated in our initial briefing that there are a number of issues, obviously, that come through. While obviously we put provisions for the protection of consumers from being abused, from being overextended, and all of that, there's also obligations for consumers, you know, to, for instance, disclose properly when they put together their expenses and all of that. So there are a number of obligations. In some instances, in fact, when we were having a discussion with SASA in regards to this issue about the card, the SASA card, you know, when they indicated that, you know, it said that when a person goes to get their money from the card, they only have like about 10 rand because there's been so many deductions that have come out of that account. And so then the money really that was intended to alleviate poverty, to buy the basics in the house, is actually now being taken by some credit agreements, which are then the repayments are debited from that. So when we were having a discussion about that, one of the things that is there in their legislation is that obviously if you are a beneficiary and you are using the money that you are getting for things that it is not supposed to be used for, so you can forfeit the money. So there is a negative consequence for you. So, you know, a whole lot of those things also beg the question as to whether that is a penalty enough to the consumer, because there are other people that are debiting this card that are not supposed to be debiting, but the law only puts a sanction to the beneficiary, but not the person that perpetrates that. So what this is showing is that there should be a balance in terms of when we put legislation to also balance the obligations of the person, but also to put the provisions that will also prevent the possibility of the abuse from happening, so that it balances. The consumer must have a responsibility, but also the credit provider must have a responsibility. So I'm just giving that example to say that, yes, in this case, it might appear like the consumer, there's no consequences for a consumer if they have not disclosed fully and then the credit was extended recklessly. If that can be proven, obviously the consumer does forfeit certain rights that accrue to a person that was extended really recklessly. So there are issues there. So the balance will always try to make sure that we find. In regards to the area around reckless lending, I know that the CEO has responded to that in terms of what they're doing, but I think Honorable I think Mabasa, on the reckless lending, as well as I think it was also raised by Honorable Okay, I don't know, but I think I'm not taking my notes properly. But in terms of what is it that the regulator does and what can be done, what are the, you know, the consequences if there's been reckless lending? There was a gap in the legislation in the sense that the regulator does not have the proactive powers to actually deal with reckless lending matters unless they are, you know, reported. And so there were technicalities around that. So hence we are proposing to strengthen some of the provisions to give them the power to actually deal with that. But I think one of the issues that we said we'll come back to is the issue around personal liability, because I think as much as you can then find and deregister and refer to the tribunal, then there's a penalty. But these things continue. They just resurface all the time. So the issue of personal liability was raised by Honorable Khadebe. And it's a matter that we'll consider, and then we'll come back to the committee with a position on that. There is an issue also that you, I think, Honorable Swanepoel, you raised an issue regarding... regarding the cost of credit, that perhaps it's not only the interest that we need to be looking at, but the total cost of credit. I think we do agree with you in that. The total cost of credit includes all of those elements. So it is important for us to look at where exactly, where do we see the spiraling, where do we see the level of abuse, where are we maybe lacking in terms of further caps. That's why we said that we will then work with the regulator to come back with the revisions around that and proposals around that, that will be properly consulted with all of the stakeholders as well. So there will be a process for that. And in terms of just the NEDLAC process, we do think that all of the policy matters that require an extensive engagement should be engaged with all the social partners, and we are committed to that process as usual. And I think the issue that has been put on the table around the levels of productivity and all of that is a matter that we probably will propose also just for a discussion at our NEDLAC forum that our minister participates in and often chairs. And because it is an issue that we need to look at. But I think there is an issue that has been raised by Honorable Waile that we would not be able to respond to you fully on that one, but it's the issue around the selling of the debt book, debtors book. We've seen a whole lot of that happening, but it's an issue also that relates to also the collection of debt that is prescribed, and because it comes from that when people buy the debt book, the debtors book, and then they continue even on debt that is prescribed. So we can come back on that issue because we still need to have a discussion as well with the regulator, because they should be seeing a number of cases and see what the gaps are in the legislation and see how we can coordinate that. Chair, I think let's say to the committee that on anything that we have not really responded fully on, we'll request an opportunity to come back, either in writing or when the committee has an opportunity for us. Yeah.
No, thank you very much. There were other points made there that I thought you may have been able to respond to now, the issues that were raised under short-term debt, for example, what sort of term is that. There were a number of issues that were raised which I think that the team may be able to respond to now, because they're not really policy issues per se. The other thing is if you could just explain the SASA issue a bit more clearly to us, because you yourself, DDG, have emphasized that that grant is to fulfill basic, to address the basic needs, food, roof over your head. Am I to understand that there's no legislation to prevent this being reduced to null? I'd like this clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Short-term credit refers to loans up to 8,000 rand payable over a period of 6 months, and the interest that is the maximum that credit providers can charge in terms of interest is 5% per month.
5%, not 5% annualized. 5%
per month. 5% per month.
to a maximum of 60.
Yeah, 5% per month to a maximum of 60% per annum.
6 months.
6 months. Sorry. 6 months is a repayment period.
Yes.
At 5% per month. Repayable. Yeah, and the maximum is 8,000 rand.
All right, that
part now is clearer for all of us. The other aspect on the SASA, that wasn't very clear to me.
Okay, Chair, on the issue of SASA, we will just speak to the issue as raised by them with us. The proposal from SASA is that the amount that is received by a beneficiary as a grant should not be included as part of the income when the affordability assessment is done on a consumer for the purpose of getting a credit. So the reason why they're making that proposal is because what they are finding is that the beneficiaries who are getting, whether it's 300 rands, whether it's a child grant or a pension for 1,270, what they find is that on the day when they're supposed to go and get their money on the first day, the deductions that have come out of it that are going to payment of repayment of credit leave them with absolutely nothing. So they're saying that the grant is not to be considered as income. It must never be considered as income for the purposes of determining whether a person can afford to take credit and repay credit. So we are having discussions with them on that, because their legislation does make it clear that the amount that is a grant amount should not be encumbered, put as a pledge or whatever. But then what happens is that the credit providers continue to use that as a basis for extending credit. So it is a proposal that they're making, but it's a proposal that, because we were still having discussions with them, Chair, you'll recall last week during the public hearings, I excused myself with McDonald because we were meeting with the NGO Black Sesh, which were raising the same issue and have written an open letter to the ministers to deal with that issue. So we are still in consultation with them and the Department of Social Development. So we should be in a position to come back with a position in terms of what we are recommending to this committee, whether we should accept that it should not be considered as such, because that's what actually the intention is in their legislation. That amount, if you are wanting to borrow 2,000, you should not put that as part of the income to say, this is what I'm getting, therefore I'll be able to repay the credit.
Just as you conclude on that clarification, and before I recognize the Honourable James, the law, am I to understand, currently allows credit providers to deduct at will from that card. How do they get access to that card? Or do they hover around at the ATM? I don't believe that either. No, I'm talking about, you know, these so-called legal ones, the so-called ones. So I want to know how this is coming off the card.
Chair, you'll recall that previously people used to go to PayPoint to be given their cash. All right. So what has happened is that obviously the Department of Social Development sought to make it easy for the beneficiaries to access their money from wherever they are. Previously, if you were a resident in Cape Town and you visited in Gauteng and your date for the grant arrives, you must come back to Cape Town to go and get your pay. So they wanted to deal with that issue by putting a system which will allow for this money to be available through this card everywhere. Mm-hmm. And also that you don't have to take the cash. You can also just use it at any shop right or whatever and just swipe and make payments. However, what happens is that because in terms of the social development legislation, the amount, the only allowable deductions from that that grant is funeral benefit, funeral scheme issues up to 10%, not more than 10% of that grant. So what then happened is that a system of payment that has now been introduced has now put that card, because now it's a debit card, meaning that any credit provider can access it, even though the law doesn't allow it. So it is a system that has allowed it to be exposed to that, and the credit providers are able to deduct it, because it's a payment system issue. Once it is a debit card, then it goes into the open loop, where it is considered like any other card. So, but in terms of the legislation that regulates the grants, it is not allowed. The only deductions that are allowable are up to 10%, and that's for funeral schemes and so on.
Thank you very much, DDG. On the same issue, yes.
Is the DDG
Mike.
Is the DDG saying that the law is being broken now?
See, this is what we're trying to get to the bottom of. You've just said it's illegal, but it's happening. Now, we want to know the extent to which so-called legal credit providers are abusing the law, in fact, breaking it.
Chair, I must say that this matter has come to our attention only, what, 2-3 weeks ago. We did receive a letter from SASA to make a proposal. So they just sent a one-liner letter to say, this is what we are proposing. But then we then had a meeting with them this year, now in January, just to understand what the issue is. And then it then did appear. So then we consulted with the Department of Social Development, because we wanted to understand what is happening, why is it happening, because this was never a problem before. Then we then came to realize that, yes, in terms of their legislation, it is illegal. They are confirming that it is illegal in terms of their legislation for any amount to be deducted from that grant for anything else other than the things that are allowed in terms of that act. So what is happening is that that is happening illegally. And so what has happened is, like I said, Chair, SASA, which is an NGO, has written a letter, an open letter to all of the ministers. So because of that thing coming to our attention at this point, we then are discussing to understand if it is happening and it's illegal, what is the law that governs it, says about it, because that is a social development legislation. And so that we can also find if there are linkages to it that we need to then propose amendments for to this committee, then we will then be proposing those amendments. But Chair, like I say, we would like to be allowed to conclude on that matter, because they were still going to come back to us in terms of some of the questions that we've asked around it. So we should be, in this process, during this process, we will conclude our discussions with them to allow for this committee to have a proposal from us.
I think that's going to be very helpful. Thank you. We will come back to this. Honourable James.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you to Mr. Netshitenzi in terms of being willing to supply the RIA. And just to confirm that, that will go to the committee chair. This is a regulatory impact assessment, ma'am.
It's here. It's in the pack. It's in the pack.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
I think, yeah. I think you've been very busy on a number of other issues.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. I will have a look. So, on the question of the source of the problem in the U.S., because what happened there was that those two federal agencies called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they were in the secondary market for mortgages, and therefore they would buy bad mortgages and resell them. And to do that, and what happened was that clearly the bill became too big, so they went back to their treasury for more money, and Obama said, no, this is difficult. We have to renationalize, not nationalize, renationalize. Okay. So they were already involved in that story. But the reason why that's important for us here is that our treasury is not going to provide a backstop either for in the secondary housing market, mortgage market. And therefore, Treasury has a great interest in regulating reckless lending. But what we do is not create the unintended consequence of squeezing the banks out of the secondary mortgage market, because it will make it very difficult for South Africans to get access, especially for people in the lower end of the employment chain, to actually get access to mortgages and therefore buy houses, which is a major asset. And one of the comments made by the banks is that this proposal here that we have before us may have the unintended consequence of squeezing the banks out of that market. It's not a good place to make money anymore. And so we must look very carefully at this thing. And that's the reason why it's really important to make that distinction. And I apologize again for not looking at my documentation and finding the RA there. Okay, thank you.
As a matter of fact, you always scrutinize the PAC, I know, in great detail. So I knew it was something beyond your control. Right. There are a few other questions that were not answered either. And I know, DDG, you spoke about coming back in greater detail. But as I said earlier, I was under the impression that some of them were straightforward. Mm-hmm. Yes, could you continue, please, DDG?
Chair, I just want to say that we did respond to the ones that were capable of being responded to. A number of them, obviously, around the area of the cost of credit, we've talked about that part, that there's an issue of regulations as well, but there is a study, because also when we then proposed to revise the regulation that deals with the percentage and all of that, it must be informed by also a study in that which the NCR is working on. But Chair, I just want to also just, in a way, respond to Honourable James around the issue of that he just spoke about now, giving the background into the U.S. Story. That it's for that reason that we said we actually appreciate the market conduct regulation, the one that will be enhanced, because the Treasury is promising that they're going to come with more rigorous market conduct regulation, because that will also deal with some of the predatory practices, the marketing that is flooded to the lower end and your short term and all of that, so that you can find a proper balance. They can make rules for that, but the basic rules around credit, they will still be in this legislation. But we have a problem around the market conduct itself, and we really feel that if they enhance that part, it's going to complement this space very well, because I think also it will ensure that we have less complaints about the credit providers in a properly regulated financial space. So we do agree that there is a need to strengthen that, but we don't want to squeeze the credit providers out of that, because consumers do need them, and we all need access to credit at any given point. So we'll try and do the balance. Okay, McDonald has one that he has picked up that he needs to respond to, Chair.
No, thanks. Maybe if you can be reminded that we didn't answer one or four,
yes,
that can be done. But I see that Honorable Waile said, there is a problem that we may want to protect the currency at the expense of the consumers. So working at the DTI, I come from the other school of thought that we would like to protect consumers, not at the expense of any other person, but there should be a balance. There should be a balance. So the currency will be protected by the rules of coordination without us losing independence from the NCR, as an example, but conferring with the registrar of banks and the like. So all this market regulator conduct that is coming, I think we will complement each other, but we should be left within our own mandate. That's how, but rest be assured that the DTI will not like the situation where we collapse one institution to deal with both consumers and credit providers, then there will be a problem. So that balancing act, I think it's natural that we must separate the two, and then I come from the other end. Then
we come back again to the cost of credit again, which I know to some degree was dealt with, but not fully. The point was also made that certain aspects of this fell under justice. But the reality is, it's under the NCA that the interest rate is capped. Am I correct there? Is it capped by finance, or is it capped in this legislation? Interest rate.
Chair, interest rates are capped under this legislation.
So having acknowledged that, let's just get down to that. The point, I think, Honourable Swanepoel, you raised was, yes, there is the cost of interest, but perhaps more important now has become the fresh loophole, the cost of credit, per se. Now, that does not seem to be kept, although in other statements that have been made here, it would appear to be. But there's no clear line on the cost of this credit at all. You see, it would depend what you call it. There's the initiation fee to start with, then there's little admin fees you add on, and then you separate this debt when there seems to be arrears into what has been paid, and you say, right, we deal with that one way. What now is in arrears, and you can't increase it beyond what is in arrears or the original capital. No, notice the original capital or what is now in this burgeoning, you know, arrears lot. Because the reality that was raised here the other day was that the people with retail accounts, and invariably it's, well, not invariably, but frequently, a number of young people have been encouraged to take these retail accounts on beyond what they could afford. And so that a debt of 336 or 350 suddenly jumps once you have a quiet word for help to an appropriate person recognized under the law, it jumps to 500 rand. Now, how is this tackled? All right, it's not more than the original amount because it's 200 odd. But 200 added on to the original debt of 326 or something is huge. There doesn't appear to be any law against that. So why are people allowed to be making these very high commissions, interests, fees? Now, some of the debt collectors appear to fall under yourselves, and others would appear to fall under the justice system. Is that correct? So we need, you see, to me there's a lot of duplication here. There's several people who are collecting debt legally, and they're all charging different amounts. Shouldn't they all be governed in terms of their fees by the one act, so that we have some idea what is happening in this regard? So if you can just get down to the bottom of that one, because there were three other outstanding issues as well. If you could respond to that lot first.
Okay, NCR, if you can just take us through that one.
Chair, I'm going to ask the gentleman here, Mr. Mashaba, to respond.
Thank you, CEO. On the cost of credit, the capping of the cost of credit, I think the best way to go will be to specify items that can be charged and cap those items. You know, for example, now we have a big loophole because the cost of credit life insurance is not capped. And what you find is there is excessive pricing and lower claims ratios. You know, the NCR is collecting statistics on this. What we have done is, in our the NCR code, we have proposed to the industry that we limit the cost of credit life to 4 rand per thousand. And we obviously have defined the benefits that must go with that. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification there. DDG?
No, Chair, and I just wanted to say that it's for that reason, Chair, that I requested that we still come back to you on the cost of credit issue. Because obviously there's a number of issues that are arising from it. So we'll go back to the regulations to see if the items are there and if the caps are still okay, and if there is a need to specify in the legislation maybe additional items, then we should be able to come back to you. But I just feel that it will be a bit premature for us to want to give you an answer right now on that issue. But Chair, on the issue around some of the things that we obviously have observed that also add to the how, you know, they price for credit. I mean, one of the things that was said was that, for instance, if you are a consumer that doesn't have any credit, that doesn't have a history of credit, you could actually be declined credit or be made to pay higher. I think those are raising questions as to what are we encouraging really. And so the number of people that actually go to open an account, not because they need it, because apparently you need it in case one day you really need to buy a car, now you need, you know, you must show that you had some little, you know, debt somewhere there. So I think that, you know, there's also maybe in terms of, those are some of the things that we think are not necessarily in our space fully, but also in the space of the regulator, the sector-specific regulator, to deal with those, some of those conduct issues in terms of how they actually approach some of these things. So I just wanted to make that point here, that there are a number of things that come up, but we realize that in some of the things, before we can respond to you, we might want to confer with our colleagues on the other hand. You know, there's issues with DOJ, there's issues with the Treasury. We'd love to confer with them, and so that we can give you a position that has been agreed with them as well.
And talking about coming back to us, DDG, can we get some clear understanding about when would this would be? You know, we wouldn't want to leave this open-ended.
I just want to say that, Chair, we are here this week and next week, so any day, maybe if the Chairperson, you know, if you can indicate by when you want us to come back, we'll need maybe a day, 2 days or 3 days, just to confer with our colleagues, and then we come back on those issues.
Well, it's on the basis then of 2 days, you see, where one could be looking at then. I hope members of the committee are listening. Today is Tuesday. We could give you Wednesday and Thursday. We also have a deadline on this legislation ourselves, because it's going to go through to the second half. So what we're looking at then is then Friday. You think you can come back with this dossier on Friday then? I think that could be helpful. I'm looking at members of the committee. Right. Okay, so we can expect that Friday then, DDG, including some of the points which were comments, such as people, I don't know, getting legs chopped off or something, amputated, and hardly been in a position to agree to anything, I suppose with a knife hovering over you. So the thing is this, that now, is that an agreement? Even though you didn't sign and just beg for mercy. Is that what you call an agreement? Is that a contract? Contract with someone under anesthetic? You see, is this an agreement? You see, and that's what's the concern here. Is an agreement with someone towing your car away without asking you, while in fact you've just come out of a head-on collision? So these are, I mean, we laugh about it, but many of us have been the subject victims of these towing specialists who get the information before the police do. I know where the accident is. And then before you look again and blink and you're in the ambulance, your car's gone. Now, is that another agreement? Who's agreed to it? So we do need that. Is that sort of thing covered by the Act, these ops and all those tiny little things that... I know, I'm told here reliably by the committee secretary that what is not in the amendment bill, as we know, we can deal with it. It would have to come to the House, you know, to agree that you deal with the principal act. So I just remind all of us sitting here about that thing. So if it's not in the actual amendment bill, we would need the say-so of the House to deal with what is in the principal act and bring into this piece of legislation. It's just, and I'm looking at Mr. Quetta as well. Is that correct, Mr. Quetta?
Yes, Chair. I think that is the proper approach to the matter.
All right. So on that particular note, we're going to ask our last input here, a very brief one, because Professor Tegener has just been hearing. She studied the documents, and she'll just give a few brushstrokes over the matter. So just a couple of brushstrokes from herself. Having her DPI now, of course, not before the submission. Over to you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think what I'll try and do in giving those brushstrokes is just to highlight a couple of what I would regard as salient issues, and perhaps to draw attention to a couple of things which may be helpful for DTI in coming back to their response, and even for members, hopefully, so as to make Friday's deliberations as fruitful as possible. On the substantive issues, the first one which I wanted to comment on is this issue of coordination with the other regulatory bodies, arising from the comments from National Treasury and the Reserve Bank, which DTI has responded to on page 6 of their slides. I think the issue here is around coordination, obviously. In general, one would not see coordination as a bad thing, you would see it as a good thing. The issue here, more specifically, I think, is in a way the balance between, on the one hand, coordination between these different entities, and on the other hand, potential erosion of independence. And perhaps a different way of putting the same thing, how to balance, on the one hand, the interests of specific groups of consumers who may be having their rights abused by a bank or whatever, with broader interests in terms of stability of the financial system and so on. So I think what would be helpful in this regard to get perhaps from DTI would be something a bit more specific than saying, yes, there's been these concerns raised about coordination. We think that coordination is already built into the bill, because there have been these comments by National Treasury and Reserve Bank on the same bill. Obviously, it's been passed by Cabinet, so it's always, in a way, a bit odd to have another government department raising input on a bill which has been approved by Cabinet, but be that as it may. Are there specific issues in the bill where National Treasury and the Reserve Bank are saying, we think that coordination is not strong enough here? Because otherwise it just becomes a sort of a rhetorical issue. Yes, is coordination enough? DTI says coordination is already in the bill. Are they saying that here we think this clause must be strengthened or whatever? Perhaps that must be solicited from them, because otherwise it just becomes a very generic issue. The second sort of substantive issue which I wanted to comment on, which has cropped up quite a bit in the discussions here, is around this removal of adverse information, or consumer credit information as it's referred to in the bill. I think this is one of the core issues in the bill, and that because a lot of the issues in the bill are really just sort of tightening up and so on. But I think this is one of the more major changes. And I think that the clarity provided by the DTI team today has been quite helpful. And it sort of does present quite a different picture from what was raised by a number of the stakeholders. I think for me personally, it would still be useful to get a bit further elaboration on what remains with the personal payment profile. So we've heard what will be automatically taken out, those two categories, and I think of particular interest here is those designations by the credit provider, like slow payer, delinquent, and so on, for which is going to be damaging. Now, in that personal payment profile, what exactly is it which, let's say, a potential employer or another potential lender would be able to access? Would they, for example, see this consumer fell behind in this month by 300 rand, you know, they then caught up and so their debt and so on. Because, you know, it's a very difficult issue. Again, it's one of balance. On the one hand, you don't want consumers who've fallen into debt, whether their own fault or not, to not be able to get a job in order to pay that off, or to, you know, permanently, or at least for the long term, be really disadvantaged and have an entire life setback. On the other hand, which I guess is where the industry stakeholders were emphasizing, you don't want to encourage reckless lending, and you don't want to eradicate market signals, which are important for them in determining the cost of credit. So I think in looking at a costing which strikes the balance between those considerations, what is the actual problem in the system as it stands? Is it that personal payment profile, or is it those designations or those characterizations of it, like delinquent, slow payer, and so on? Because if the problem is just the words or those categories of delinquent, slow payer, and so on, in terms of employability, then taking those out is going to solve the problem. But if it's the problem for someone getting a job is the details which are contained in the personal payment profile, then as it stands in the bill, it's not going to solve that problem, because if the potential employer can still access that information, it might not be categorized as slow payer, but they'll be able to make their own conclusion that the person is a slow payer. So ultimately it's going to become a political judgment for the committee, for members, as to where to come down on that balance. I think one particularly important advance in this aspect of the bill is the automatic aspect, that whatever falls away automatically, so someone doesn't have to go through a lengthy and costly court process. I think that's important, but the issue becomes what is it that falls away automatically, what remains, which is the part which is damaging to consumers, and which is the part which is still needed by potential future credit providers. Then a third point which I wanted to raise is about, I guess it's a more generic comment on the system as a whole. I think it's quite important that this entire system of debt, credit, and so on, and how people can get out of a difficult situation, be as simple, as transparent, as accessible, and as low cost as possible for people who are already in a difficult situation. So they need to know who to go to, how to access that at a low cost, and so on. Now, there does seem to be a multitude of different players here, the debt counsellors, the regulatory authorities, alternative dispute resolution agents, the PDAs, and so on. I think for even for ourselves, if we find ourselves in that situation, who would you first go to, and then what, and so on? It can be quite confusing. And a lot of these different agents are also taking cuts. So even when people are starting to pay back, how much of what they're paying back is sort of leaking out. Is there a way through this bill of streamlining that so that it's not excessively bureaucratized? A fourth issue to touch on is maybe it would be useful for DTI as well as the committee to try and make an assessment. I mean, presumably this would have been done by DTI before bringing the bill, but in the light of the comments which have been raised, to what extent the problems which members have drawn attention to are issues which can be addressed through the legislation, and in the sense that they are deficiencies of the present legislation, and to what extent are there issues of implementation, consumer education, and so on. And insofar as the problems which members have drawn attention to both today and even in the briefing held late last year on the bill, insofar as those problems are manifestations of gaps within the legislation, is this bill sufficiently addressing them? Because the DTI team has said that, look, the current system is basically sound, the bill is a good, the Act is a good piece of legislation, we're basically tightening it up, cleaning it up, and so on. Can we envisage that, let's say, in a year or two's time, if the issue of credit and debt and so on were to come before this committee, would those problems still exist, or would they have been addressed by the amended Act? Would people still be talking about loan sharks, about high interest rates, and so on? So it might be useful to try and hone down to maybe a great extent that was done. I've seen the review document from DTI, which informed the legislation, so on, but maybe even in the next few days, some of that will be revisited. Do the current amendments address those insofar as they can? Can they be strengthened? And where the problems can't be legislatively addressed, what are the end of the channels for doing that? Is it consumer education? Is it better capacitation of the regulators? Is it stronger implementation through the justice system and so on? And then lastly, just to say, I mean, DTI has mentioned that they will be coming back with obviously substantive responses on not just on the questions raised today by members, but issues raised in the public hearings. I think there was a range of issues which have been raised in the public hearings. Some of them are dealing really with the specificities of drafting and so on. But some of them go to drafting issues with a particular policy slant, either tightening or loosening of the bill as it stands. And I think it would be really important that perhaps in that Friday session there be a substantive response by DTI on those. I think just having looked through the stakeholder comments, some of the key issues which were raised was around definitions, the issue of a probity test versus a fit and proper test, a range of issues around PDAs, the issue around voluntary termination of the registration of debt counsellors, and deregistration of alternative dispute resolution agents. Obviously there was a number of others, but I think those were perhaps some of the more important issues which haven't cropped up in today's discussion. But I think it might be important not to lose sight of those for the Friday session.
Thank you very much, Professor. Appreciate that. It also indicates you were listening very carefully this morning as well, as it were, analysing on your feet. Thank you. Members, we're on the point of going to luncheon, but I believe the lunch is still arriving. Or it's there, is it? Yes, it's there, I believe. But there are a few things we all need just to go over as a committee. So before I do that, let me say to DTI, and of course the entire team of NCR and the tribunal, state law advisor, parliamentary law advisor as well, and those who've come here from stakeholders who've been here the whole time. It had been our intention to hold the meeting again tomorrow. I've explained our earlier medical issues with respect to members of this committee, and indeed my own. So we've readjusted the program to still get to the point where we are on time, you know, still meeting all our deadlines. And what we are going to do is this. We are scheduled to hold meetings, well, we were Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So tomorrow, being Wednesday, We've already seen that DTI needs time to come back with certain responses, you know, fully prepared, as it were, and fleshed out. So we will not meet tomorrow, Wednesday. I hope I'm making myself clear to everyone. Please make sure that media is aware of this, because they say they sometimes don't get the information off the website. Please. They're not sitting here now, but they may have intended to come tomorrow. We will sit on Thursday under the chairpersonship of the Honourable Kwabasa. We'll sit on Thursday. And on Thursday, we will do these issues here. Ms. Herling will brief us. I'm not sure if this was handed out, but some of the concerns just identified already with respect to the amendments, and take us through that. We will also have DTI going over certain aspects that they can work on already without going through the entire document. We're sitting from 9 o'clock until 12. All right, and then who was the other? Right, perhaps even more important than that, we asked stakeholders to provide us with responses to our questions and comments that were outstanding. Do you recall that? Now, those are already in, some of them today, yesterday. The rest will be in today, and we'll get that. And Mr. Hermans will chivvy those up who haven't responded. And we'll get that on Thursday as well. So you'll get those responses, all matrixed, you know, with our question and the response. You'll get the DTI on the certain issues there. You'll get Ms. Herling in particular, and the researcher who's looked at a few other areas that are of value to us as well. I think one of the areas that may have been dealt with tomorrow, but perhaps on Thursday, is the whole question of the SASA card, which we're learning is legal, is illegal to carry out such things, and yet is happening. And it may be that the NCR can also cast some light in that regard. We ourselves, of course, could have asked the social development, but I think the department, working with the administration there, will get a quicker response than we will ourselves. I'm looking at yourself, Mr. Nyetse Tensi, you see, as well, and the DDG. One other thing, we have been collecting the comments, media comments, on this. They were made last year in the main, the media comments that were referred to. I'm asking for a package of those media comments to be made for you, so you've got them handy, as it were. So what we're looking at then is that on Thursday. You may get the packages Wednesday, but you know, we'll go over it Thursday. Ms. Professor, you'll be coming next Tuesday, having already, you know, received all the comments of DTI on the Friday. Is that correct?
No, but I can't do Tuesday.
Well, that's all, you're coming on Friday then. Is that the idea?
Well,
I suggest the two of you work on the administration of that. But what we do need is a written comment and you talking to it early next week or Friday. And Friday may have been too soon if DTI are only coming back to us in detail this Friday itself. The other note, of course, is on Hansard. We asked Hansard to be here yesterday afternoon. Are they still coming in the truck to Parliament today? Because I'd like it before I get on a plane. So Hansard will be here, and that is of last week's meetings, not today. You'll get today's meeting, I imagine, on Friday. So that's quite clear on that lot. So I don't know if there are any questions about that. So on Wednesday, there is no meeting. This week. Thursday, there is a meeting. There is a 3-hour meeting Thursday. On Friday, there is something like a 6-hour meeting. Yeah, well, there we are. We have got a long program, primarily because of deadlines. That's 9 o'clock to 1 or whatever, to go on until 1500 at the latest. That was scheduled last week, you see. We don't have a choice on that one because we cannot sit next Thursday. Next Thursday is the State of Nation, the Sona. We can't sit on Thursday. That's part of the problem. And we... Friday we are meeting. And I know Friday happens to be St. Valentine's Day next week. And the 14th next week. Is that so? Well, I don't want to give us a history of where the name comes from, so let's leave it.
It's not Catholic.
Valentine comes exactly from there, but as I said, I'm going to refrain from giving you any ecclesiastical history, although it's very, very interesting itself on that one. But we are going to sit there. It's not simply because it's Valentine's Day. I know that a lot of you would have relatives down for Sona and may have wanted to have spent Friday with them. So I'm telling you in advance, please to liaise with your partners.
This is more romantic.
Indeed, indeed. And I hope no one else gets ill. We will be getting Honourable Kubasa in. And our whip is not at all well, and we must acknowledge when these things are a reality and give people the space to recover. I think that's very important. So are there no challenges on the left? On my left, no challenges with that revised program.
No challenges, but I was just trying to confirm with the secretariat if I heard well, that we're only coming to present on Friday, and not on Thursday.
Well, you're coming here on Thursday on other issues that will be raised, you see. Remember, the stakeholders are responding. Yes.
It's fine, Chair.
Yes,
you just misunderstood that you meant we are coming to present on Thursday. No, we'll be here on Thursday, but we will come with our full response on Friday.
That's it. Okay. I hope that's quite clear. I'd like to thank everyone very much. There is lunch available outside. Thank you. Can I speak, Comrade Joe?
I'm stuck.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.